Dealing with Anger, April 8th, 2019. Pastor John.
You will in the coming months. But just because I'm the pastor, I'm going to exercise my privilege. Trust me, okay? These things are very helpful and will enable us to discover, to realize it. We probably know, say, we know who we are as a church. If you were a husband and wife in my office, and either husband or wife said to me, my wife knows what I'm thinking and what I'm saying. She knows the words before they're on my mouth. You know, that's not true. It's not true. There is so much about ourselves that we are blind to, both positive and negatively. And so these surveys are very important. Now, there are two that are take-home type surveys that are on the back table. If you have not received those yet, please take those home with you at your leisure, fill them out, bring them back next Sunday, no later than next Sunday. Now I'm going to ask for two more, okay? On next Sunday, right after church. You know, next Sunday is Father's Day. I am not one who embarrasses dads a lot, okay? And I emphasize a lot, but we are going to have something special for you. Susan, our office manager, and I have been busy visiting the stores around that have these. And we are going to have a dad's root beer in a bottle for every dad that's here, okay? If you prefer, what's the other thing? Cream soda. If you prefer cream soda, I always have to get those because that's what my wife prefers. Even though she's not a dad, she can have one. Everybody can have one next week, okay? But we encourage you to be here. Bring your friends. But next Sunday, because it's Father's Day, I know you're going to want to get out of here and get to your place wherever you're going to take your noon meal. I understand that. But please also understand we are in a time as a church where we kind of have to make some adjustments. Immediately following the service next Sunday, there is going to be one more survey given to you, okay? And this will be for up to 30 of us. It'll take place right down in the fellowship hall. It is a standardized test. When I was at my church in Tucson for 29 years, I used this test at least twice during our history there, just to find out, just to get some feedback from the people and hear, how are we doing? What are our strengths and what are our weaknesses? I have found no better tool than the one that will be used next Sunday morning. We don't have it here to pass out to you. It's not the way it works. It will be like an administered test, okay? Darla Sievright from our New Church Specialties office will be here next weekend with us, the whole weekend. And right after the service next Sunday, she will administer this test to all who will come. And we need up to 30 of you. Rolf is going to have this sign-up sheet, right? Is that right? No, Maureen. Excuse me, I'm confusing. Maureen is going to have this sign-up sheet available right after the service this morning. Please say yes to her and get your name put on this. It'll take between 30 minutes and 45 minutes, okay? So you'll be able to get to where you're going. Please take this seriously. This will be very helpful. It's called Natural Church Development, the survey, and Maureen will have this for you as you leave. Maureen, let me give it to you so you don't have to come chasing it. Rolf is going to have another sign-up sheet because next Saturday, this is not a written thing for you. This is an opportunity for you to sit down with Darla Sievright, who will be with us from New Church Specialties, and have a face-to-face 20-minute interview, just you and her. And some of you, that scares you spitless. You don't have to do it, okay? But for those of you who would like to do it, we really would encourage you to sign up. There are 20-minute slots starting at 12:40 next Saturday afternoon, the last one wrapping up at 5:20. So I would really encourage you, take advantage of this. Darla's a really nice lady. She will not scare you, and she's going to ask everybody the same questions, but all of your responses will be different, and they will all be compiled. So this is just one more of those metrics that we're using to find out who we are, where we are as a church, and trying to discern where God is leading us from here. Okay? So, Rolf, here you go. Now, Rolf is the quintessential salesman. I've already experienced that. I can see it in the way he talks and the way he holds himself. So, don't be surprised if Rolf collars you and says, you will do this, right? Okay? It'll be a good time, and I really appreciate your cooperation with this. Okay, where's my Bible? There it is. I'm going to talk about something this morning and next week that I'm not just targeting you. I have presented these messages wherever we have been in our transitional assignments. And there's a couple of reasons for it. We're going to be talking about anger. Now, there's a couple of reasons for it. Last week, if you were here, you remember that one of the reasons that it's healthy to take several months to a year, more if necessary, to intentionally walk through a process of self-discovery and of hearing from God and sensing His Holy Spirit's leading. One of the reasons that it's so important to take time to do that is because as a congregation, we are mourning. We're mourning the loss of a beloved pastor and wife who were here for 12 years, profound impact on many of us here. Undoubtedly, some of you, one or the other, Frank or Thelma, led you into a relationship with Jesus. They're gone. You understand that? There's a season for everything. It's time for them to retire and enjoy what years God has left for them. It'll be interesting to me to see what kind of ministries God leads them into, because, you know, old preachers never die. They don't stop preaching in some way or another. But the reality is, we as a church now are trying to readjust our thinking, first of all, to this big ugly guy who stands up in front of us on Sunday morning instead of the bald guy who did before. That's just minimal. But there are so many other things that we're adjusting ourselves to. And part of the mourning process, that readjustment process to a new world, is anger. Whether you recognize it as such or not, it's there. And if you have experienced it yet, you probably will. Now, that is something that is just a very natural and healthy part of this mourning process. But whether or not you experience it in response to Frank and Thelma's leaving, if you're human, you get mad. You get mad. Am I right? Amen. You get angry. Things tick you off. It's part of the human condition. Do we as Christians, too often we think, yeah, I'll just bury it, okay? Because I got to put on that nice face and not really admit what's going on inside of me. And so we tend to bury things. I want to talk about anger because it is so much a part of the human experience. And it's part of our world today in an extraordinary way, and really to an extraordinary level. I don't think that You and I, in our lifetimes, have experienced as much palpable anger in our culture as we're experiencing today. Would you agree with me on that? It is mind-boggling, and if you allow it to, it can really get you down. I am a peacemaker at heart. I really like to make peace and help people come to peace. And it sets my insides to churning when I listen to the evening news. So for the most part, I don't. The anger is palpable. The reality is this: the last two generations, Gen X and today's generation just stepping into leadership, it's called the Millennials, two of the most angry generations that have ever walked the face of the earth, let alone our own country. I am one who doesn't just look at what is. I like to ask the question, why is it the way it is? And there aren't always answers for that, conclusive answers, but there are generally some indicators. And honestly, I think this anger thing and what we're sensing in these two most recent leadership generations, the youngest generation coming up is called Generation Z. Are you aware of that? And we don't really even know what their characteristics are going to be because they haven't lived long enough and they haven't experienced enough of our broken world to really develop their own characteristics. But Gen X and the Millennials, they were raised by us baby boomers. And I hope I don't offend you too much, but I believe that a lot of what we're experiencing today in anger in these generations, if you're a baby boomer like I am, it's our fault. It's our fault. One of the things that started it was Dr. Benjamin Spock. You remember that name? Dr. Benjamin Spock, very gifted, intelligent, and became nationally, in fact, worldwide known, made his reputation by claiming that any kind of punishment, corporal or otherwise, was unhealthy, would damage the psyche of the individual, that individuals needed to have freedom and space to be who they are, make the decisions that they would make with no restrictions, and that infected our generation's mentality on how we raise children. Interestingly, a little while after Dr. Spock's major impact, there was a secular university, and I'm sorry I don't have the name of that school, but I believe it was in Southern California, perhaps USC. Their early childhood development program decided we're gonna test this out. If it is really unhealthy for a child to be restricted, to not have boundaries, then we're gonna do this. Now, up to this point, their early childhood development section was kind of in the middle of the university. The students would walk by it during their break between classes and whatever free time they'd had. And that early childhood development building was surrounded by a fence, a chain link fence, about 3.5-4 feet tall. And during that time, the children, when they were on play, and the students would interact with them. Well, now this mentality that boundaries are unhealthy came about, and they said, we're going to test this. So they had the fence taken away from around their building. Now, according to theory, that should have set the kids free. And they should have been free to go out and interact with the students even more than they had been up to that point. But you know what happened? The children literally clung to their children's workers. They would not leave their side. They would stay next to the swings and the slide and the merry-go-round as long as there were one of those workers that they knew there. But they would not, they were terrified of those students as they walked by. So after a matter of months, the leadership very intelligently said, you know, this may not be a correct supposition. So they had the fence rebuilt. The day that it was rebuilt, the children right back out to the fence, interacting with the children. Appropriate boundaries are not only healthy, they are essential to healthy human behavior. And one of the things that happened because of Dr. Spock, and by the way, are you aware that Dr. Spock late in his life, he apologized in print to the American people and said, I was wrong. Forgive me. It's too late. But because our generation as baby boomers was raised with this assumption, we raised our kids with as few boundaries as we thought we could get away with. And our kids, instead of growing up healthy and secure, grew up angry. Because we don't know what's right and what's wrong. We don't know how far to go. We don't know how far to go it is and be safe. So I think one of the fundamental reasons for the anger of Gen X and millennials falls right on my shoulders and yours. But of course, there are many reasons for the anger that these generations are experiencing. There's parental abuse and dysfunction. There's spousal abuse. Of course, there's bullying. There's terrorism, domestic and foreign. There's government overreach. There's church malfunction. Undoubtedly, many seated right here who have been part of God's church, following Jesus Christ, hard after him. Undoubtedly, almost every one of us could tell tales of the bruises and the wounds that have been inflicted on us in the church. Today, there are unprecedented levels of depression. Pandemic in our culture. Do you know what psychologists tell us depression is, bottom line? It's anger turned inward. I don't want to bug anybody else with it. And so I began to be angry at myself. If I would have only done this, if I would have said this, if my parents had done this. I read somewhere that depression is basically anger without the enthusiasm. Yeah. Anger. That begs the question, as Christians, is anger itself sinful? No. No, God created us with the capacity to get angry. Psychologists call it that fight or flight reflex. It's both an emotional and a physical reality. There is no way that you and I can totally avoid anger. It's impossible for us as humans. Anger itself is not sinful. It's how we respond, of course, to anger that can be sinful. Let's take a look at Jesus. Quite often we use Jesus as our scapegoat in anger, especially as Christians. Well, Jesus got angry. Yes, he did. Let's look at a couple of things about which he became angry. The first is, both of them are very familiar to us. The first one is recorded in John chapter 2, verses 13 and 16, through 16. Let me read them for you. It was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration, so Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He also saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and the cattle. He scattered the money changers' coins over the floor and turned over their tables. Then going over to the people who sold doves, he told them, "Get these things out of here. Stop turning my Father's house into a marketplace." Was Jesus mad? Of course he was. You better believe he was. Why was he mad? Well, I'm sure what I'm going to share with you is not new to you, but let me refresh your memory. Bottom line, when Jesus came to the temple, he saw especially the poor being ripped off. They were just being abused. What was going on? Well, of course, it's Passover. And so, Passover was basically one of two Jewish holidays during the year that if you were anywhere close to Jerusalem, if you were within traveling distance of Jerusalem, you made it a point to be in Jerusalem for Passover. We're told that during Passover, the population of Jerusalem swelled to over 2 million people. Now, if you've lived in Sedona your whole life, you have no idea what a crowd is, by the way. You have no idea what traffic is, okay? Probably one of the reasons you live here is because you don't like it when you go to Phoenix and you experience all of that. But 2 million people crowded into this small space. And the reason they were there was to worship at the temple. And what worship was all about over Passover was they would bring an animal for sacrifice and give it to the priests in the temple to sacrifice on their behalf as atonement or a covering for their sin. Okay, that's according to God's instruction. Nothing wrong with that. The problem is what it had devolved into. People would come if they were if they had the financial means, or if they were agrarian, they were shepherds themselves, or what. They might bring their own sheep, their own lamb. They might bring their own turtle dove, and they would bring it to the temple to offer to the priest and have the priest sacrifice for them. There was a major problem, though. Because in order for those animals to be accepted as appropriate and worthy to be offered as sacrifices, they had to go through an examination by one of the scribes or Pharisees. And their animals were declared almost without exception unacceptable. They're not good enough. But I've got good news. The bad news is your animal's not good enough. The good news is you can go buy an animal that's already been pre-approved right over here at this table. Now, there's good news and bad news about that too, because you can only buy one of those animals with temple currency. So the money that you brought from wherever you came, even if it's just in the outskirts of Jerusalem, your money's no good here. You have got to get exchanged for temple currency in order to buy the appropriate sacrificial animal. Of course, the exchange rate was abysmal. Pennies on the dollar. And so when Jesus comes and he sees all of this happening, he is ticked. Because the poor people especially, the ones he declared time and again, those are the ones primarily to whom he came. They were being abused. So that's part of why he was mad. But there was more than that, more to it than that. In Mark's gospel, his account of this cleansing of the temple, we quite often call it. He makes this statement, Mark chapter 11, verse 17. Jesus said to them, "The scriptures declare my temple will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have turned it into a den of thieves." You're undoubtedly aware, I'm sure you're here. If you've been here for long under Pastor Frank's ministry, you've talked a lot about the temple. The temple had several courts. The outermost court was called the Court of Gentiles. And that was a place, that was an area of official temple ground that was open to anybody, Jew, non-Jew, didn't matter. You went in, the next court in was the Court of Women, and then there were other courts, more, each one progressively more exclusive as they went into the worship areas of the temple. But here Jesus is saying, you have turned this court of Gentiles that was intended to be a place where anybody from any culture, any nation, any language could come and worship and pray to the one true God, Yahweh. You have turned that into a marketplace. It is so noisy. It is so out of control. Nobody can pray there. And so you have sacrificed prayer for the almighty dollar, the denarii in that situation. That's what really ticked Jesus off. Have you ever noticed, I just read it a moment ago, but in John's account in chapter 2, in verse 15, there's a simple little statement. It's described how all of this is making Jesus mad. His response was, in verse 15, he made a whip. Why? Think about it. All kinds of animals there, all kinds of shepherds, all kinds of, even the bulls that were there for sacrifice. There were whips all over the place. That's what animal herders used to control their animals and to get them where they were supposed to go. There were whips all over the place. Jesus could have just picked up one of those whips and did his business. But he made a whip. Why? I see this as Jesus' version of counting to 10. Took time to braid that whip. Jesus, you remember, was fully human and he was fully God. The human part of Jesus was really angry. But he knew, I have got to make the right kind of choices here. I've got to get control of my emotions. Got to back off for a minute. Got to cool off. And after he had made the whip, then he used the whip on the animals to drive them out. He turned the tables of the money changers over. Let me take you one more place where we see Jesus' anger. This is, again, one of the most well-known of stories in the New Testament. This bottom line, it's John chapter 11, but it's the story of Lazarus. Lazarus, let me remind you, was apparently one of Jesus' very best friends. His sisters Mary and Martha, the three of them, had a bond with one another that was special. Lazarus, Jesus got word that Lazarus was sick. Jesus was in another town. He was on his way to Jerusalem. But he didn't immediately respond and hotfoot it up to Jerusalem so that he could heal his friend. In the meantime, Lazarus died. When Jesus and his disciples arrive in Jerusalem, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Mary and Martha, of course, are distraught. The professional mourners are doing their thing. You know, you're aware there were literally professional mourners in that culture. Women who were paid to weep and wail for a week. That's why they're called professionals. They were being paid. this wailing was going on as Jesus comes on the scene. Mary comes out to Jesus and said, Jesus, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died. Why didn't you come immediately? Verse 33. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, a deep anger welled up within him, and he was deeply troubled. Now, just a side note, this is one of the reasons, this verse right here is one of the reasons that I chose to begin taking the New Living Translation seriously. That's why I'm using it today. All other versions there that I have read all my life basically said that Jesus was deeply troubled in spirit or something to that effect. And we understood that. I understood that. But when I read this, a deep anger welled up within him. Wait a minute. So I did some serious study. It's called exegetical study. Okay, you got it from Pastor Frank all the time. You won't get it much from me. But I really dug into this. And the best understanding, the best translation of that phrase, deeply troubled, and he was mad. I had missed that. Until maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I had missed it. And wow, what's going on? What is Jesus mad about? Is he mad at Mary and Martha for them being upset at him for not coming? Is he mad at the ruckus raised by the professional mourners? Is he mad at Lazarus? Dude, if you would have hung on just a little bit longer. Is he mad at himself? You know, if I would have come sooner. I don't think it's any of those. What I see happening here, Jesus, I describe it as a primal anger. His anger goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. The first time that humanity rebelled against God, said, no, I've got a better idea. I think I'll do it my own way. And what entered into the human experience at that time was something we were never intended to experience. Pain. Death. What made Jesus mad was the reality that the broken nature of humankind and his friend Lazarus was one of the most precious of those humans that he himself had created, by the way. And he was so mad at Satan and what Satan had done in deceiving that first couple, Eve and Adam. And the fallout from that. Every human from that point on died physically, and generally the death was a result of a prolonged suffering of some kind. And it caused suffering among all of those who knew them and loved them. That's what Jesus was mad about. His was a primal anger at what sin and Satan had done to his creation. What was his response? Well, he defeated sin and its deadly effects. He raised Lazarus from the dead. It was temporary, and he knew it. Lazarus died again. But Jesus, showing who he was, he had the authority. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. And he showed it right there. But it was, bottom line, a response to his anger at sin and its impact upon his human creation. today. Psychologists tell us that the vast majority, they estimate 95%+ of the anger that you and I experience walking through a typical day, the vast majority of it is selfishly motivated. In other words, I get mad because so-and-so did this to me. That idiot! Don't they know that turn signal is supposed... Would you get off my tail? I would love to cram my brakes on right now and let you crawl right up over me, and I'd sue the snot out of you. The vast majority of the anger that you and I experience comes about because somebody did me wrong. You were unfair, you were abusive, you did it either intentionally or unintentionally, doesn't matter, you still did it. And you did it to me, you violated my rights, I have a right to happiness! By the way, you don't. Bible doesn't say anything about a right to happiness. I'll get back at you. I would love to slam on my brakes. You see, what happens is this taps into every one of our broken, sinful nature. And the enemy of our souls, Satan, is not just some theological figment of the imagination. He is very real, and he's very active right now. And whenever you and I get angry, as God's children, whenever you and I get angry, we are tempted to lash out and take retribution. Somehow, I will get even. I don't get mad, I just get even. But you see, that's in stark contrast to Jesus' anger. The anger that we so often use as a cop-out. Hey, yeah, I get mad. Jesus got mad. What's the big deal? His anger and my anger, the vast majority of the time, are qualitatively different. Jesus' anger was never selfishly motivated. He had no sinful nature. His anger was always directed at sin, at Satan, and its destructive impact on his creation. But because I have a broken, sinful nature, my anger, whether it's selfishly or unselfishly motivated, even those few times when my anger is caused, it's not self-centered. It's what we might call, and what we have in the church called over the years, righteous anger. It's a very, very small percentage of the time. But even when it is unselfishly motivated, even when it is a righteous anger, Satan always tempts me to respond destructively. Always. Always. And what I have discovered, both in my own personal experience, and in just a few years of ministering with and to other folks just like myself and like you, there is only one cure for anger. And it's not time. Time dulls the pain, but doesn't fix the anger. There's only one cure for anger. And that's for me to choose to forgive. That's the only thing that will deal with the root of my anger. To forgive. And it goes from as simple an example as the person following me too close, so close that I'd love to jam on my brakes. And the only cure for that in my spirit is control your... And then when they pass you finally, you want to flip them off and do whatever else. The only cure for anger is to choose to forgive that person right there, right then. I forgive you. See, the problem is, though, and here's where the rub comes. We really don't understand, for the most part, we do not understand what forgiveness is, what real forgiveness is. That's what we're going to try and look at next week. Romans chapter 12, verse 19, the Apostle Paul said, "Dear friends, never take revenge. Leave that to the righteous anger of God, for the scriptures say, I will take revenge, I will pay them back, says the Lord." You see, we must choose to forgive, and whenever we don't choose to forgive, we start playing God. It's a form of idolatry. God, I understand what's going on here. You can just back off. I'll take care of it. We start playing God. And you know what happens to us when we begin to play God? We break. We break. In just about every way. I'll tell you some stories next Sunday of folks that I have worked with over the years for whom at least they thought it was virtually impossible for them to forgive. And they told me, I can forgive a lot of things, but not that. Never. Never. Not going to go there. And the evidence of that choice to play God was so evident in their lives, everybody could see it but them. The problem is we greatly misunderstand true forgiveness. Next week, we're going to look at true forgiveness. What is it? What is it not? How do we do it? And what happens when we do? That's next week. I know some of you have already told me you're not going to be here next week. Too bad for you. I really hope you can be here. I really do.